Welcome, welcome, welcome. It's the 100th episode. How exciting is that? Thank you for tuning in, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast. My name is Scroobius Pip. This is lovely. We've done 100, or we've done more than 100 because of the parts ones and parts twos and all that. But still, this is the 100th episode and the 100th guest. And it's very exciting. And it's crazy that we've got this far. It blows my mind that we've not missed a week, and you guys often don't miss a week, that we've been doing. Yeah, we've been going on and on and on and on consistently for this long for free for you guys. So it's crazy how much it's grown, and the dice was rolled long ago. It's nuts. It's nuts. I don't know. I've got a tendency or an inclination now to ramble on too much and give an Oscar nomination speech or an Oscar winning speech, but I won't. Because in reality, we've not been nominated for shit. We're purely just kept going because no one's stopped us. But thank you for tuning in. And yeah, it's mind blowing. Obviously, I'm going to give some thanks. Actually, we're going to get on to the 100th episode, which had to be Mr. Dan Lesak, obviously. Who else could it be? Loads of you have been asking for this for ages. So, we thought the timing was right. And we'll explain in the podcast why the time was right. Turned into a two-parter, obviously, because we get rambly. Anyone who's seen us live will know how much we can ramble at points. And Dan Lesak is one of the people that needs thanks from this podcast, because he advised me on all the kits. So when I started off, so the kit that, you know, I take to everyone's houses and record all these episodes on was all given to me, or not given to me, I bought it myself, but was all advised to me by Dan Lesak. So that's great. And there's a breakdown of that kit in the Distraction Pieces book that's coming out on August 3rd. I should mention that. Come along to the live show, man. On August 3rd, it's my birthday. And the book launch, and we're doing a live podcast at the Leicester Square Theatre with you guys as the guest. So we're going to line people up. I've already had word that a few previous guests are looking to come along. So if that happens, I'm thinking I'll have you guys line up one by one to come on stage and ask questions. And then every now and then I'll take a pause to interject a previous Distraction Pieces podcast guest. So that's hugely exciting. And the big one that I'm going to be recording and releasing is at the Leicester Square Theatre on August 3rd. I've also announced now that I'm going to be doing kind of a mini podcast tour and a book launch tour. And the idea of that, I'm going to record one or two of them. I think we're going to be doing one up at the Edinburgh Fringe, and then maybe one at a venue I played years ago in Glasgow. And we're thinking of recording them maybe. And the nature of them is going to be similar to the London one. You can all come along and you can queue up and come on stage and ask questions. And it's not like when there's just a mic in the crowd. You get to say, what is your favourite song that you've written? You come up and you sit down and we have a little chat. You pick a topic or you pick a subject or a question and I answer. And if there's response that's required, then we go back and forth. Obviously, within reason, there's normally a lot of people to get through, but that's how they're going to work. But also, we're going to do a load in book venues, in libraries, in all sorts of places around the country. And they're going to be the same. They're just not going to be recorded. It's going to be a live Q&A with you guys. Because, again, I was asked if I'd just go around and do a tour of book signings. And that sounds crap, man. I mean, I'll still be doing the book signing part of it. It's just, I don't know, that it feels a bit gross. It's fine. It's what people do. But I'd feel like Katie Price with a far smaller queue, just turning up and signing and smiling. And yeah, it's, I don't know, it felt cheap. So I thought instead I'll put the time aside to go around the country as best I can and pop into as many places as we can and do these little Q&As, interact with you guys, hang out with you guys, have photos and do the books signing lark. So that's the plan. That is the plan. I've not mentioned speechofelementrecords.com, the ever-running advert on this podcast, because it's my record label. And speaking of Edinburgh Fringe, twofold I'm going to speak of Edinburgh Fringe here. On my website at speechofelementrecords.com, you can buy my Edinburgh Fringe show for me a few years back that got all four and five star reviews. Didn't get a single review, less than 4 stars, I don't think. Had 19 shows in a row, all sold out. So you can buy that and have a look. But also, you should be hugely excited at the fact that B. Dolan and Sage Francis are coming to the Edinburgh Fringe for the first time this year. And because I did 19 shows, they're being dicks and doing 20 because they've got to outdo me. But they're doing 20 shows at the Edinburgh Fringe. They're then doing a handful around the UK as well, all on their websites and Facebooks and on my website at scroobiuspip.co.uk. Or if you go to speechdevelopmentrecords.com and in the bottom bit, click blog. Then you can get all the information there. But yeah, I recommend you check that out. It's going to be amazing. It's the first time they've done a spoken word show together in the UK. So it's going to be huge. So I'm excited about that. What else can I tell you about? I've got on that little book tour, I posted the planned route and dates online the other day. It was a huge, huge reaction. So thank you very much. And in like a 10-day run, I had 1 day off scheduled. And that day off is purely because I'm going to be in Edinburgh during the Fringe. So I'm thinking I could probably record 4 or 5 podcasts with the amount of people who are going to be up there that would be interesting for the podcast. So my plan is to not only record a load of live ones, but to backlog and build up a whole catalogue of great guests while I'm up there. So I don't really have days off. And I'm going to be driving around the country, probably on my own, it's looking like at the moment. I'm trying to figure a way to bring Chris of Redshift of Rebels and of the Drunk podcast, which we're going to have new ones to kick off this new, the next 100. God, that's depressing, isn't it? That we're kicking off the next 100 with me and my mates Drunk. But yeah, I mean, I need to go back into the fact that we've had 100 and launching with the first 4 of we had Russell Brown to kick things off. And then Zane Lowe, which was one of my favourites, because when I announced that the first 4 were Russell Brown's, Zane Lowe, Alan Moore and DJ Yoda, Zane seemed to be the one that some people were like, oh, I don't like that dude. And then when it came out, everyone was just hugely won over, because I don't care your outside opinion of Zane, and you don't have to be into his stuff, but if you listen to that podcast, you see the dude's a good dude who's passionate about music, so that's great. And straight off the bat, the 5th person was Sage Francis, the man, the myth, the absolute a legend. I'm gonna list. I might list all of them. We then had, this is gonna be a long intro. We then had Simon Singh, who was amazing and like broke down the mathematics that's hidden in The Simpsons. He brought an Enigma machine in and explained how they broke the Enigma code in the war. I'd Warren Ellis on shortly after. So straight off the bat, I'd had Alan Moore and Warren Ellis, 2 of the greatest comic book writers ever. I then had Jodie Ann Bickley, and then B. Dolan and Sage Francis, Edinburgh Fringe 2016. Then Open Mike Eagle, then Simon Pegg for our big Christmas special. And that was a massive one. He talked about having popped on set at Star Wars and didn't mention that he's actually in it. I had Killer Mike after that, which is, man, that was one of the deepest experiences of my life. The dude, I still get that quoted constantly. And there's some great quotes from that in the upcoming book. So that's a great one to check out. Then I had FullFact.org, who are hugely important. And again, that was one of the first ones I had that were kind of unknown. And it went down a treat because FullFact.org are a fact check company and website. And they fact check tons of political statements or addresses or newspapers and Facebook posts and things like that. And they're hugely important, particularly with all the Brexit stuff and any voting and election stuff. They're hugely important. So I then had Josie Long, who was absolutely amazing. Stuart Lee, who's an absolute idol of mine. Riz Ahmed, who's in the new Star Wars now. Absolutely amazing. Kate Tempest, who has just grown and grown and grown, and recently had a great clip on Australian TV of her ranting beautifully and articulately about the state of the world. Had Rufus Hound, had Nick Frost, had Mike Skinner. That's the first 20. Damn, that's an insane 20. And then we got straight off the off harder on that. Frank Turner, Billy Bragg, Dylan Moran. And then I had my first Ask Pip episode, which is essentially what spawned the live ones. The live ones, I was like, people really enjoy the Ask Pip one, so I'd rather have people there to ask it and get involved. Then we had Wes Borland, only the second American of that. No, there'd been loads. There'd been Sage and Open Mike Eagle and loads. Then Rob the Bank, then another Ask Pip. No, I never put the second Ask Pip episode up. There's a mystery Ask Pip episode that never I made it up. Then Rue Reynolds from Enter Shikari, then Sarah Pascoe, then Paddy Considine, the legend who's killing it in Peaky Blinders at the moment, then Danny Wallace. Then was a massive one. We had Eddie Temple Morris on, and that was a huge one because we got really into some deep discussion about mental health straight off the bat, and that was the first one that I got messages about for like a solid year after that, and the next one's coming up in a bit. But yeah, that was the first one that just seemed to be it's kind of ever living and means a lot to people. Then we had Ricky Hall, which was a really good one because it was getting people to see him rather than just this model that's got all this coverage and some good, some bad. In fact, we talk about that in this episode with Dan Lesak. Then I had Howard Marks, beautiful Howard Marks, rest in peace, my friend, amazing man. And then on the way back from Howard Marks, I sat down with Dan Hardy and did a two-parter. So that was a long day. Then there was another Ask Pip. Then I had Paul Vickery from the Prince Charles Cinema. Again, that was beautiful. That was one that, again, an unknown one that went down a treat. The lovely Michael Smiley. I love that man, and I'm a massive fan of him. Then we had the episode with Mr. Heggie, who does all the artwork for Speech Development and loads of other stuff. And he was tattooing me as we did the podcast. So that was kind of intense. Next up was Gail Porter, and that's the second one that, man, I was hearing about that from you guys for weeks and weeks, or months and months to come. I still get regular tweets about that one. That was amazing. Then Ramesh Ranganathan, which was amazing, and I've been on his podcast since, and he writes the foreword in the book, in fact. He does the foreword in the upcoming Destruction Pieces book. Then Amanda Palmer, who was absolutely amazing and beautiful. Then we had the first kind of weird, unusual special. We had the British Red Cross, a Refugee Week special with Ramel, which, yeah, it meant the world, and it spawned a track and a record and all sorts of stuff. So check that out. Two-parter with John Ronson, absolute a legend. He features in the book a lot. Flux Pavilion was amazing to talk to a nerd out with. Then we had a two-part Doomtree special with POS and then with Dessa. Then I had the only ever Skype one with B. Dolan, and I don't like Skype podcasts that much, so we only did one, but that was to launch Kill the Wolf. Then we had episode 48, it was with John Tolley of Banquet Records, which was amazing, getting to hear the ins and outs of an independent record store. Then it was Neil Maskell, who just brilliant, far more intelligent and articulate than anyone could have hoped or imagined. He's an amazing dude. And then John Kennedy, who told one of the best stories of when he worked in the BBC music library, or vinyl library, I think it was, which was amazing. And that was the first 50. And at the beginning of part two, I'm going to talk about a second 50, because you probably just want to listen to a fucking podcast now. Yes, it was beautiful to have Dan Lesak, and the timing was just right. People have been asking about it for ages, but if we'd done it just after we stopped working together and I launched the podcast, it would have been a bit, so how have you been? Yeah, I'm good. You know, so we've left it a while so that we've both been out doing stuff. So part one, we get really into everything that Dan's been up to. We get into how he got into music, the start of his career, and we get a bit into me and Dan. And then in part two, we get into more Lesak versus Pip story. So yeah, I think you're going to really enjoy these. And this is the 100th episode. It's mental. Oh, I should also mention excitedly that Mr. Dan Lesak will be the guest DJ at this month's We Are Lizards at the Book Club in Hoxton. So that's June 25th, Saturday. We're going to have Dan Lesak and Sam Redmore. It's going to be a nice, busy night. We've been doing it at the Book Club for years now. And all the best songs, I put on a rubber lizard mask and sweat while I DJ. It's fantastic. We have great fun. So come on down. If you want to get on the queue jump list, because it gets pretty hectic anytime after like 10, it gets a big old queue. If you want to be on the queue jump list, send names to info@thetrashsociety.com. That's info@thetrashsociety.com. Put it in your diary. Come on down. This is Distraction Pieces Podcast, episode 100 with Dan Lesak. This piece of fiction is the intro to Destruction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Destruction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Destruction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Destruction Pieces. Start rolling as we're talking. It's been really good. I had one bit where the first time I got it, I recorded the Zane Lowe one.
And then I took the memory card out to try and look at it, and it was blank. But it's these weird files that you can't look at it. You have to use their converter and plug it in. So I shit myself. I was like, oh, God, I've done the first one and there's nothing there. But then I phoned someone and figured it out. And there was another time where it was full, but again, I was being ignorant. I was deleting on there, not realising that at some point you have to format it to get it all off completely.
Right, yeah.
So it was saying, I was like, I've only got four recorded, yet it's not letting me record anymore, so I had to just...
It's like it's deleting the tag, but not the actual file.
So I still don't understand that, but I just know that at some point I have to...
And it's got a drum machine.
It's got a drum machine, which I've not had to use. It's got loads of stuff I've not had to use. And Mike Skinner, when I was in with him, took great joy in telling me how overspecced I was. And he said, it's fair. He said, I enjoy the podcast. And to be fair, it does sound better than any others, but you know you can do them on an iPhone, right? As I lugged in my Pelly case and all that. But I'm joined by Dan Lesac. How you doing, sir?
I'm good, man. I'm good. I can see my name on your little screen.
Your name's on there. And this Pelly case I just mentioned was formerly yours or ours or...
Ours?
For one of our tour things.
That was given to us by a fan. Someone
really?
Who liked us. Yeah.
That's good then.
I think he worked for the BBC at some point. And so I think we stole that Pelly case off the BBC.
I like it because it's bright yellow. It makes me feel like I'm a builder or doing something more manly than all the shitty, unmanly things I do that just involve talking and poetry.
I've got that one, but in bright orange.
Yeah. So, understand that. You're more interested. Into the orange.
That's prefer good. The orange.
It's been a while since we caught up and hung out, isn't it? I was thinking on the way up, it's got to be Dolan's gig at XOYO in September, was that? For some reason I had November, but yeah, it's probably September. You're probably October. Let's split the difference.
Split the difference, yeah.
How have you been?
I'm good, man. I'm good. You're good? Yeah.
It's nice to be in your pad and see everything, a multi set up, which kind of goes the things we're going to talk about. I mean, obviously, people have been requesting us to sit down on the podcast for ages, so we will get to Lesac versus Pip stuff at some point, but there's loads of Dan Lesac stuff that I want to talk about first, and I'm going to start with your computer setup. So what I learned from online and from talking to you is one of the things that you've been doing a lot in the last year is playing computer games and doing it online, and is it Twitch or is it a separate streaming thing? Twitch.
There's a few of them. There's like Hitbox and YouTube Gaming and stuff, but Twitch is the only one that's actually good.
And it's what I was excited because I was like, right, as soon as... Because we've been talking for a while saying we will do a podcast, but we'll wait until the right time and when there's stuff to talk about. And it's been nice because I've kind of wanted to ask you about it, but thought it'd be good to find out on the podcast because it's massive. There's a guy called Demetrius Johnson, who's a UFC fighter, who's massive on it. There's a WWF guy called Xavier Woods who loves it.
You know, the wrestling types.
It's the wrestling types on there, but the nerdy wrestlers are nerdy MMA guys. but yeah, it's massive, right? And it's streaming not only a feed, or it can only be a feed of you playing, right? It can just be essentially your screen as you're playing, but it also tends to be feeding a stream of a video of you as well, going,
exactly.
Hello, I'm playing.
Hiya, I'm just chatting away. So, like, it's what... do you remember Justin.tv?
Yes.
Yeah, so it is Justin TV. It's what that evolved into.
Right, I see. Yeah,
I don't know if Justin... I don't actually know if that still exists, but
I think it does, because that was like a streaming thing, and then it had a chat room on the side of it kind of thing.
Yeah, it does have that still. So you have live chat room to the side of the video, and so your viewers come in, and they talk shit to you, and you talk shit back to them, and...
Do they talk shit to you all via text?
All via text.
Does that fuck up your gaming if you're kind of glimpsing over at someone?
It does.
You're shit. Like, I was about to kill that person. Or even someone saying you're great and then you're about to kill someone.
Yeah, because it's like, it depends what you're playing. Yeah. Like, because I find it fascinating when you see people playing games like CSGO, which is like really strategic, intense, first person fucking shooter.
Yeah.
I can swear, can't I?
Yeah, swear all your fucking life.
Oh, knobs. if you see someone playing that, and they've got to concentrate, yet they're engaged with their chat, and some of them have like 4,000 people sitting there watching
them,
and they'll be just chatting away, owning, like being amazing at the game at the same time.
Just casually talking.
How do you do that?
It's the shoot 'em up ones and that initially put me off online gaming, because I think I had Call of Duty.
Yeah.
And I was enjoying it. and then I went online and I got PTSD. It was genuinely the most intense and horrible thing in the world because people were so angry and so obviously amazing at it. But I was like, oh, I'll join this team.
Yeah.
And then they're like fucking furious.
Yeah.
But again, it's evolved a lot since then as well with the streaming and that as well. That just illustrates how quick it all is now and how high spec it is.
Yeah. And like those with games that are as big as something like COD, that you're going to have shitters. The percentage of shitters doesn't change in life. There's always just going to be a percentage of knob jockeys. But when there's millions of people playing that game, you're going to bump into more of those shitbags.
Yeah, and the fact is as well, I guess, as it's got bigger, there's a broader audience or range of people on it. Similar to how there was a long time where YouTube comments, it's just going to be horrible people being horrible. Yeah. But that's kind of opened up a bit now and people are just, there's some shit as there's some nice.
But like you build a community.
Yeah.
You build a, like, there's people I see.
Because that's the thing with Twitch, all right, it feels like a very much, similar to, I guess, when you first went on Twitter or things like that, that it was a thing that, regardless of who you are, a thing that you're on there and that you're part of this community. It's weird because the one I was going to liken it to, which makes me sound a bit sleazy, was Suicide Girls. Because when that website launched, it was a community as well. And it was very much, I was on there early on and there was a great group of photographers I used to talk to and street art people. And it was this whole thing that it was this tiny area of the internet that happened to have boobs on it as well, which is awesome. Yeah. But it was a community that wasn't your regular mainstream one, which is similar to Twitch in a way, because it's not, if you're not into gaming, you're not in that community. It's very simple as that. You're not going to be a casual Twitch fan, can
you? But you kind of, it's that thing of like, the thing I enjoy about it, the thing I most liken it to, is it's that after we had done a gig, the bit standing outside afterwards.
Yeah.
Because anyone who's coming to a gig that you're performing at, you're going to have something in common with.
Yeah, 100%.
And it's the same on Twitch. They only come into your channel because you have something in common, whether that's like your sense of humour or who you are or the type of game you play, you know, because it's every genre of game and I play very particular types. So I attract people who like those games because I like those games and we have this shared knowledge and shared thing. I'm going to say just bang and thing and doodad.
Do you find you watch a lot on there as well? Because that was one of the weird things as well. A thing that's confused people a lot, but if you've ever been playing computer games with a load of mates where you're not going to get to play every 10 minutes, you realise how amazingly engaging it can be to just watch and not have that control. And I think that's the thing that a lot of people who aren't massive gamers or have never been in that situation are confused about Twitch, because it's like you're watching someone else play a game. Why would you watch it? But again, it's engaging because it's going, oh, no, you kind of want to tell them not to go in there or learn from what they're doing. And
although
like
that would be a sin in my chat. Yeah,
you're not allowed to advise or critic.
You're not allowed to backseat me. You can tell me I'm shit.
Yeah.
That's fine.
You can tell
me I'm good. That's
fine. You can't
say,
you should go down there, Dan.
But yeah, don't tell me that because I
like it.
It's like sitting next to someone while they're watching a film. And so, like, you can say to me you're going to love this bit.
Yeah.
But don't say you're going to love this bit because
it's
where Wolverine gets his claws out.
I like it.
But like, you're not just there watching that person play games.
Yeah.
Because of that chat room. Like, I don't have like a huge number of viewers, like 30, 40 a night, but you're there with those 40 people.
Yeah.
So, I know, we're playing The Witcher 3 at the moment.
Oh, what is that? I'm clueless. I only play sports games now. It's terrible.
Okay, you know. So like, you play this badass, like, monster hunter, essentially, and there's loads of titties.
Awesome.
Yeah, basically, it's like 13th century titties. Great. Like, fantastic. Eastern Europe, brilliant.
Great.
But yeah, there's just loads of titties. So there's a bit where we can make love to a prostitute.
Sweet.
And
it's getting creepier, the fact that
it is.
I'm just sitting there with 30 people and they're watching me make love to a prostitute.
Yeah. But no, what makes it worse is like I got everyone to decide which. So it became this this debate over brunettes and redheads and blondes.
That's fair.
And it was like super creepy.
Yeah, I like
super
it.
Super creepy.
I like it.
But like at the same time, it's funny because it's not arousing. It's video game.
Of course sex. It is, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
No one ever looks like they're actually touching anyone. We're not at that point in
technology.
Technology to realistic. Make it look real.
So what kind of games in general do you go for?
Just so you know, we had sex with all three prostitutes.
All three. I mean, that's good.
That just seems like the right way to do it.
Yeah, that's a democracy. It's finest,
exactly.
Isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. I just, you know, people voted one way, the other way. Well, for you guys.
Yeah.
For you.
Yeah. I like it. Let's see all of them. So what kind of games? Is there a variation of games? And is it all new games, or do you play older games on that as well?
I actually tend to play a mix of, like, older stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Final Fantasy VII was a couple of months ago. We just did Chrono Trigger, which is an old SNES game, which was fucking awesome, man. I nearly cried.
Rings a bell.
It's in the same vein as Final Fantasy and all that.
Yeah.
But then indie stuff as well. There's a game called Enter the Gungeon, which is just like nice pixel graphics running around a dungeon, shooting shit. Dose One did the soundtrack to it.
Amazing.
It's a dope soundtrack.
That's pretty awesome.
So like indie stuff as well. But I tend to do, if I can, I want a plot. I want a narrative.
Mm-hmm.
With the older games, because all the stuff's text, I get to do voices.
Great.
I get to act it out and play. Like, people seem to like that, and because I don't take it seriously.
Yeah.
But as long as it's got something to get my teeth into, you know, like, the reason I don't really play things like COD is just because I've got nothing to grab hold of. There's nothing I care about in those characters.
Yeah, sure. I'll
there was that. One a little while ago, The Last of Us. If you're Xbox, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm Xbox.
If you know someone with a PS4...
Yeah.
Borrow it and just like £15, I think The Last of Us.
Yeah,
is
I remember
now.
Reading about it at the time.
But Walking Dead kind of thing. But
yeah,
the main character, the female protagonist as well. You just fall in fucking love with them.
You
will cry.
I remember hearing The Last of Us, and there was one or two others around that time that seemed to be the first that they really felt it was a breakthrough in. Right, we've got actually amazing. Truly amazing plots and storylines, it could just be a film. Obviously, that's not to insult games or downplay them, but it's that level of everything has come together where this is, it's like playing a film rather than watching a film.
There's a difficulty with gaming in general because of the quantity of content.
Yeah.
You think, all right, we're going to make a film.
Yeah.
Okay, that's 2 hours.
Yeah.
We still have to pile hundreds of thousands or millions of pounds into making that film.
Yeah.
But we can make sure that 2 hours is
spot on. Yeah.
Now take a game. We've got to do 40 hours and we've still got the same budget as that film.
Yeah.
So we can't get Scroobius Pip to do that voice acting.
Yeah, I'm very expensive.
We're going to have to get... Who's the cartoon actor version of Scroobius Pip? We'll get him.
Yeah.
So sometimes the... if you come in from the outside, it's just a tiny bit cheaper. It just takes a little bit more of a suspension of disbelief to engage. But because you're with those characters for 40 hours...
I was going to say, because you've got that... The downside is that, but a huge positive is the character development time.
Yeah,
the
you
space
get so
you can
much
just
more,
build it
and
into
you,
it.
You forgive any bad acting in a way.
Yeah.
As... Okay, I can forgive that because I've fallen in love with this character.
You've got into that's a story so much. It's where I genuinely think it's where the power balance is starting to go over to TV from film is exactly that. It's like, right, you can tell this story in... I mean, these days you can do it in 3 hours because everyone's happy for a kid's film to be 3 fucking hours long.
I know.
It's like, go ahead. Yeah, but the fact is you could tell it in 12 hours or 16 hours and really get into these characters and these stories, which seems to be... It seems to have been embraced now on the artistic side of it. Like, the writers and actors and all that seem to be the ones going, wow, I can get my teeth into this, rather than it just being the TV companies that are like, well, we've got to fill it or whatever else. So
yeah, and it is funny, actually, when you go back to watching... Go watch House of Cards or go watch Jessica Jones and like the amount of time it takes you to fall in love with the characters and then go watch any movie, and it's like, oh fuck, I have to fall in love with this guy
now,
in 10 minutes.
Quick, yeah, you know, it's over soon.
But this is why I find, like, Marvel, I find really fascinating, because we've got this extended universe.
Yeah, yeah.
So they have to grab you with Captain America in that first 20 minutes. You have to learn to love him.
Yep.
But we still get 6 movies.
Yeah.
To see him develop and change and all that.
And to see him in other people's contexts, to sling him into this context, in this film, in this area, where he's not all the focus on him, and see how you feel about him then, or where he's maybe kind of, you could perceive him as the bad guy, you could perceive him as this or that, and that's kind of,
But it's definitely like, with the Twitch thing, it forces me not to just play the same game over and over, like multiplayer online, which I did when we were recording, or just before we started recording Repent, Replenish, Repeat, I just played Call of Duty Black Ops 2 for 6 hours a day in my house and swore at people.
Yeah.
It wasn't healthy.
No.
But like the Twitch thing, no one wants to see me do that. But they do want to see me play through
Enjoying some
of the greatest narratives of the last 30 years. So I get to do it.
Yeah. Do you get a lot of offline gaming in? Like, it's a weird one. Is the addiction to go, right, I need to be online in front of everyone, but then is there also, fuck, I need to practice on this one because I'm not up to how I'd want to be kind of thing, you know?
I don't practice. I get the meme, I suppose, on Twitch is get good.
Yep.
Which, so I do my getting good on stream. So if I start, if I'm terrible, I'm terrible.
Yeah.
But you get to experience me going, okay, if I dodge and then cast this spell and then do that, I got it, you know?
So
during Final Fantasy VII, when we played that, there's these 4 optional bosses, and 3 of them are, like, fucking rock hard.
Yeah.
And that was, like, I actually Instagrammed a photo. I was sitting in a cafe, and I had all these napkins around me where I was making notes of, like, because that game's really... There's lots of builds, and you can equip things that do certain, you know. Yeah. So I was like, oh, okay, well, if I equip that, and that, that'll do this. And I'm sitting there, and I must have lost like 2 hours of my life sitting there. But I refuse to go on and practice it.
Yeah.
I'm going to learn on screen.
I used to do that tons with Championship Manager. Again, very different gaming, but amazingly immersive. The fact is, I'd be at work or college or whatever the next day, and I'd be looking in the paper for what footballers are good or what youngsters are coming for, and going, oh, he's scored a lot this season for Port Vale, I might try and sign him. And like you'd be using real life scenarios to inform you on that. And the weird part was, more often than not, it would work. And it would because they're so well researched, it would be if you're playing a version of the game that's 2 years old, if someone has started to come good, if you go and snap them up, someone had probably seen that they're going to... Their potential was there, and it's bizarre.
I always find games like Champ Manager fascinating because they... like, that point at which you start in reality, but then you're off in the future, and these imaginary players have to come through.
Yeah, that's when you have to be really into it, when you're playing in 2020. And
it's like there's no real relevance.
Everyone's retired, they're all fictional... All the best players, or as it used to be, all the best players happen to be the names of the programmers that made it. Oh, this guy's come through as a youngster who's great. It's like, he's one of the creators of the game.
And like, Perfleet are now in the Premier.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's like, all right.
It's weird. But it's enjoyable. I mean, I'm glad we've talked on gaming this long before inquiring. Is there any... I know people can make a lot of money from gaming, and again, but also I didn't want that to be the first question because that's not the point of it, obviously. But from what I know, a lot of people have made a lot of money from gaming on. I don't know if it's more on YouTube though, on walkthroughs and things like that, and things like where there's these huge amounts of followers and watches. Like, is Twitch monetized?
So there's money on the internet.
Yeah.
We know that. Like, with YouTube, you can monetize through advertising and all that stuff. Yep. And those big YouTubers make money by just, like, brute force, shit tons of short, edible content.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's not... The YouTubers who I really enjoy, there's a guy called Jim Sterling and a guy called George Wiedemann.
Yeah.
Who goes under the name Super Bunny Hop. They make these really in-depth. It's still gaming, but they do like one video a week, but it's 45 minutes long and it's a actually informative piece.
Yeah. You know?
I don't see how those guys make money.
Yeah.
Because they're putting 40 hours in to make something.
It's similar in that way to podcasting. That if I broke every podcast into 20-minute pieces and put them all up, I would get kind advertising of advertising points on each download. But that's the same person downloading all five of them coming. Yeah. And again, if this one, like, I feel this one might run long because I think you're the person I've spoken to more than anyone else.
I would have thought
pretty much in the last decade. I've no idea if our conversations were interesting to anyone else, but we've spent a lot of time
talked.
With mine, I'll stop it at an hour or an hour and a half just because I know for fitting on a phone, that's kind of a decent amount to not fuck you up completely. Whereas if it's a 3-4 hour podcast, you might not be able to get it all on, or you might have to delete stuff depending on what phone you've got and all that. But yeah, so it's more based on that. But again, if I was being clever, and even in charts, like the charts are based on your downloads, and you'll look at a lot of the stuff in the charts, and they're 10-15 minute podcasts that go out 4 or 5 times a week. It's like, well, I don't believe that they're getting more listeners then, because it's the same listeners over a longer amount of time. So that's a similar thing, essentially, I guess, on the YouTube advertising that. And if you want to be money focused on the game thing, you can do, here's the first 10 minutes, here's the next 10 minutes, whereas the people who are actually into it are going, here's what I'm showing you. If I can make some money from it, that's a bonus, but the art of it
is YouTubers make the same way make money the same way Pirate Bay do.
Yeah.
They just have a lot of adverts you know, just like, it doesn't actually matter of the quality of it. It's just get as many adverts ingested.
Throw them in your face.
People. Yeah. Whereas with something like Twitch, obviously people can just give you money.
Yeah.
It's like there is a sort of like tip your entertainer.
Amazing. Thing.
Yeah, so you just get tips.
You're like a nerdy cam girl.
Yeah, I love pretty it. Much. The nerdy cam girl. And like the weird thing about tips, it's like they get, you can set like the lowest tip, but I set mine to like £2.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be like, yeah, if you want to fucking tip me, you have to give me a tenner.
Yeah, sort of thing. Yeah.
But people then can like, they have a message and you make a fuss of it and all that. I make a fuss of everything. If someone hits the follow button while I'm streaming, I get a notification. It comes up on screen. A little thing comes up.
Nice.
Followed the channel. Da da da. So everyone gets to see it. And there's a really old sample of this like 50s radio show that comes up. No, for follows, it's The Prodigy sampling the Beastie Boys.
Sweet.
Yeah. Actually, I got like 400 follows in like space of 3 minutes.
Yeah.
My alert plays every 10 seconds and it played for every one of them. So it went on for like more than an hour of just the same noise over and over. But it's like, no, I have to cope with this. Turn it off. But no, this is,
that's the point of it. It's the deal that's been set out there.
So, yeah, you can make money that way. Once you get a bit bigger, you can get partnered by Twitch, which means you're guaranteed to have quality options on your video, so you can put out a really high quality feed.
Right, wicked.
But people can choose. I can put it on mobile or whatever. You're guaranteed that, but people pay you like $4.99 a month. Twitch takes half. You take half.
Right. Cool.
And what I find weird about that, and what I find fascinating about that, is you don't have to pay them any money. It's free. The whole website's free. Yet there are streamers who, like, I don't want to give away people's numbers, so without names, but there's streamers I know who have 5,000, 6,000 subscribers.
Yeah.
I'm not partnered, so I have zero. But, so they're making a ridiculous amount of money.
Yeah.
Yet that's because people choose to pay it.
Yeah.
It's not because they have to.
Yeah.
The perks aren't enough to, subscribers are often immune to adverts, so they won't see like video adverts in their stream. But the streamer decides when to play them, and most of the decent streamers don't play them anyway.
Yeah,
because they're not going to make enough money from them. So it's like,
then again, it's a loyalty thing. It's a I want to put my money exactly. down on this. It's similar. I'd not to always bring everything back to MMA, but I get annoyed when people ask me where they can stream an event that's on, because it's like, right, no, the enjoyment I get from it is worth the money I pay for it. Yeah. So I want to pay for it, because I think it's a fair thing. Even if I could watch it for free, I'd still be paying my monthly subscription or whatever else. It's like, no, it's worth that. It's fair. So it's a similar thing that they're going, I don't need to pay this, but the enjoyment I'm getting is worth $4.99 a month or whatever else.
I was looking at my I recently went to America, and I was looking on my phone, and I use Spotify for my music on my phone.
Yeah.
And I looked through the list of stuff I had like available for offline. There's not an album there I don't own.
Yeah.
And I'm not a big fan of, I want to support those bands.
Yeah, completely. Yeah.
I want them to have money from me.
Yeah.
So I've given them my tenner to buy the album, and then I'm sort of giving them a little bit more.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I just feel like if you love something, you should be willing to support it.
I completely agree.
But I also understand that not everyone can.
Yeah.
Like, when you think about it, right, Kanye West.
Yeah.
$10 to Kanye West has a different value to $10 to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like what $10 means to him isn't the same as $10 to the kid who is at college or whatever, like grinding away, working
completely.
And trying to pay like university fees and all that. That kid's 10 is worth a hell of a lot more than Kanye's 10.
Yeah.
So I can understand it, man. I can understand why you would want to not pay.
Yeah. Completely. It's similar on the podcast front of I've decided not to have a Patreon thing and donations and that.
Because
it's like, right, I'd rather have merch. And if you can afford the merch, then buy some merch. Even if, and it sounds odd, but even if you don't want it, if you're hitting me up saying, oh, I listen to the podcast, how can I donate? It's like, if you're listening for free every week, then if you can afford it, it'd be nice to buy something. But I'd still rather you buy something and have something than you just throw some money at me and go away. And if you can't afford to, then that's fine. Do you know what I mean? There's no pressure there. I like it as a setup of you can buy something and get something, or you can just, it is what it is. I've got sponsors and so on and so forth.
We're going to talk about this probably in a bit with the music thing, but like, I definitely feel like giving people the opportunity to pay for something whilst making it available for free is, on one hand, more noble, but probably more profitable.
Yeah, it makes
because
sense.
Because you're not excluding someone on
you're not putting
basis
anyone
of
off.
Their financial situation.
It's weird, because we spoke of we've hinted at the timing being right to sit down and talk, and we've both got kind of some mutual timing, which seemed like a good point, of it's the 10-year anniversary of No Commercial
Breaks
and we're doing a little documentary that Tom and that are making, that they're going to be talking to you. And have they spoken to you yet? They're going to be speaking to you.
Yeah, they
I know they've
me.
Emailed, but I don't know if they've been up yet.
I texted them back, gave them some dates.
I'm keeping out of it because it feels weird to be involved
in your
in a documentary that's kind of going to be about me and probably won't be negative.
It's like,
I don't want any involvement. I like the idea of it because we did get all this footage. Look at that.
Fucking
action.
Love it. Love this street.
We did get all this footage and all that, and it's... But again, the thing on that, I've kind of decided, I've not mentioned this on the podcast or anything, we'd said we don't know what we're going to do with it, but the thing that we filmed all the way along was called the Relying on the Kindness of Strangers tour, which is where I first played for you and kind of birthed Daniel Sack versus Scroobius Pip and all that. But that just that name, it made me realise, right, well, we have to put it up as a pay what you want.
Yeah,
because it's the Relying on the Kindness of Strangers tour, and it's literally that. It's like, here it is. You can have it for free if you want, but if you want to pay, we've spent months and months making it and filming stuff. It'd be cool. And the other, the mutual anniversary is the 10-year anniversary of Le Sac Say Yeah, which was your...
It's the 10-year anniversary of that show.
Of that show,
The first show was Daniel Sack. I don't know when Le Sac Say Yeah came out.
Because was that before or after? Because I know I had it. It must have been around then. It was after.
Because I don't know, that was just like, I don't ever count that as a release, because it was just like, I'll be honest, it was grubby me cashing in on us two starting to have some success.
Right, yeah. I loved it. It was a great record. I was into it.
I did. No, I was like, I'm proud of the record itself, but I released it I did
as a here's some. I need some content out there that's available to.
I did release some copies in like a pocket
because we took our sweet ass time to do our album as well, so it made sense. So yeah, I got mine in a jean pocket, and it had a thumbprint on it.
Yeah.
And it had some stuff that would have been in a jean pocket. I think we're in one of your jean pockets. So it might have been a plectrum or a receipt and stuff like that. So it was a CD in a jean pocket. And
somebody got £10.
Sweet. That's
so
not
bad. I sold a copy of Lasaki. So yeah, for a fiver.
Yeah.
In a denim pocket that had a tenner in it.
Brilliant.
Because I'm genius. Weird. Because I just thought that was beautiful. These things that go in a pocket.
But I mean, we're going to get around to everything, but all mutually. So the timing thing was these anniversaries, and you've got a new record out that's again in time with that first gig and all this kind of thing, exactly. or in this year. But yeah, let's continue on that. So for me, I had Lasaxa as a in a pocket. It had, I believe, it had Rapper's B on, right?
Rapper's B was on, yeah, there,
which turned into Rapper's Battle because I had a song on No Commercial Breaks called At All. Which Rappers Be At All was... I always thought that was clever. Because Rappers Battle sounds like it's a title that we've come up with, but it's a squash together. But that was the first record of yours I really heard. How did you kind of come about to finding your sound to becoming Dan Lasaxa? In fact, let's go all the way back to how did you start making and working on music? Because you studied music at college and stuff, right? Or at school.
I did... GCSE music,
and
I think I did AS music. I don't know. I got kicked out of that college, so who knows?
Who knows?
The one you never went to, but I only ever met you at Palmer's.
At Palmer's,
like you weren't. I thought you were at Palmer's College.
I went there in the end. I wasn't there when I met you.
Right.
I was just knocking about.
Always in the
canteen. I was just kicking it, knocking about, just hanging out. Just doing drugs and getting drunk.
Yeah, so like...
It makes me sound way cooler than I was, but that's what was going on.
My cousin Billy is like probably 10 years older than me. He had a studio and stuff, and he'd had some success. He had releases on like Acid Jazz and a few labels like that. He had... If I remember rightly, and Billy, if you listen to this, you can correct me via text or email. I think he got fucked over... for a track called Cool Strut by Sony. Like, they signed it to stop other people signing it.
Right.
You know, and it kind of...
Yeah,
but...
Like Liverpool in the 90s.
Basically,
right, to sign youngsters to stop them going anywhere else.
Yeah. But, yeah, so, like, he sort of inspired me when I was, like, 13, 14.
Wicked.
And I convinced my mum and dad to buy me this really cheap, like, MIDI synth. It just had loads of different sounds in it. Mm-hmm. And an Atari ST, secondhand Atari ST.
Wicked.
And, so, like, probably for the first, from, like, 13 up to, like, 18, I just had this Atari ST and this one synth.
Yeah.
And learned how to program.
That's dope.
I'm not very nimble. Like, I've never been that. I'm not actually a great player, musician-wise.
People have seen you tear it up in the middle of our sets or at the end of our sets would be surprised at that statement, but I also do know how much you've practiced and had to go in to really get that tight, because it particularly again the I say famous, it makes it sound like we toured stadiums, but the famous ending
we did Wembley Arena
we did, but the big ending of Letter from God to Man was always just so it looked huge and sounded huge. But again, I had an awareness of you've
it's
drilled
practice,
this and
real practice,
at points I would know when it's gone wrong and you're pulling it back and where it is because it is all live and natural and it is like, oh shit, I've done that one, but I can build that into something and all that. So yeah, it's interesting that there wasn't a natural nimbleness.
Yeah, and like now
dexterity.
I can play the bass and a bit of guitar and stuff. I don't feel like I'm not a musician.
Yeah,
but like it took a lot. I'm not naturally, you know, like Yilla. Yilla's a really good example of obviously, if you're listening, you don't know Yilla. Pip did a track called Astronaut with him years ago. Yilla is a naturally talented musician.
And he recorded the vocals for Angles. We did all of Angles at his
place. He helps us mix Angles and stuff. But he's like, just pick up an instrument and can play it. He's just one of those people. I'm not that guy.
Yeah.
You know.
He'll look miserable as he's doing
it. Oh, God, he'll look well grumpy. Oh, I'm so talented. Makes me so sad.
I love him.
But yeah, so like, But the programming,
yeah,
like the mathematics of music, fucking loved it. I always had.
That's wicked. That's really interesting.
Like, this kind of because I had this shitty equipment, I had to work out ways of tricking it into making sounds that it wasn't meant to make.
Yeah.
So, like, it had no effects in it. So, you know what a delay pedal does?
Yeah.
It does
Yep, yep.
Well, I didn't have a delay pedal, but I worked out if I programmed the note and then another note slightly quieter and slightly quieter, and I could sort of get
building
that effect.
Your own echo that you're controlling.
Exactly. And, like, that then gave way to when, by the time I got to 20, I borrowed. I can't remember how much money I borrowed, but I borrowed more money than I could physically pay back. It's like 1,500 quid or something to buy a Mac.
Yeah.
I borrowed it from my mate Jake. He's still like my best friend to this day. But I told him, because we were photographers.
Yeah.
We'd done our degrees and stuff, and we were going to start a photography company. And I was like, well, I'll borrow the money so I can help you with the Photoshop stuff.
Yep.
Always fucking knowing that I was going to buy Reason and Ableton.
To make beats.
Make beats.
Produce. Yeah.
So, you know, completely blagged him.
Yeah.
It's weird, actually, because a decade, well, more than, like 15 years on from that day, I still work with him.
Yeah.
Although...
Because I was going to say, he's a successful photographer.
He
now,
is,
and has continued that, and he's got his company, and you do work with him with him and all this
kind
of thing.
I'm his assistant.
Yeah.
I'm a photographer's assistant.
Yeah.
It's good fun, actually. I love it.
Again, I'm kind of jumping all over the place. But how's that? Because you were really into photography and you were a successful photographer and had been, I think, published and exhibited in kind of ways and things like that. So, and then I always remember when we decided, like, Dan Lissat versus Scroobius Pip got successful by accident, essentially.
Oh, God.
And you were in quite a good job and you had photography and I was doing a few different things. And we did have to sit down and go, right, are we going to do this? Because if we sign this deal, then... you've got to throw away a decent job and this and that,
and, it was, like,
and we focus on it.
I was doing graphic design for a really big, big international fucking accountancy firm, like one of the big four.
Yeah.
Or are they called the big five now? I don't
know.
And
Inflation,
yeah. But like, I'd had that job 11 months, I think. I'd left HMV because we were both HMV scrubs. HMV, And, it was the first time in my life I actually had any money.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden you were going to go, ah, fuck it, I'll become a jobbing musician.
Yeah, and I remember those first few gigs we did, I could afford to do them.
Yeah.
Because I still had my, like, yearly season ticket.
Right, yeah.
So I could get in and do the gig for free. So I remember we did that gig in, like, Watford or somewhere, Kate Nash. Album launch or signing.
Yeah, yeah.
Signing,
I think it was a launch thing or something, yeah.
And we got 50 quid for that gig.
Yeah.
And, yeah, the only reason we came away with, like, a tenner each was because we didn't have to pay for my train ticket.
Yeah,
you had fuel out of it.
Yeah.
We both,
like, I just drove.
You just
everywhere
drove.
In my van.
That was weird, man.
But yes, so how is that? And, we'll continue along the Genesis line, but how... Not the band.
Why not?
But and the band. But so how's it been to kind of get your teeth into photography a bit again? Because a lot of people, photographer's assistant, that kind of sounds like, oh, you're making tea and stuff. It's not. It's technical. You need to be technically talented and knowledgeable to be a photographer's assistant.
So I'll go out on shoots with Jake, and that's my job, is to make his life easier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I'll set up the lights, I'll make sure that everything's pointing in the right direction, and he does this what they call gel lighting, so he uses a lot of colored light, and he's definitely got his own style, and it's a really hard style to copy because gel lighting's really hard to make look good.
Because he'll seem to use, like, quite a few different colors and that, but to really bring everything out, so not in a here's a load of colors fucking thrown it your way, and you'll notice in this highlight you've got a bit of green, and
all
then there's a bit of pink in this highlight and things like that.
Like, and using the model to using the model to separate the light, which is kind of. But so he's very meticulous and particular. So from that point of view, it's nice to get my teeth into something technical,
because you've got to learn how he wants it essentially to then be able to replicate his.
But the other thing he does workshops. So he teaches gel lighting.
Yeah.
And we do, like, one, two a month in a studio out in Amersham. And it's only, like, a group of, like, eight people.
Yeah.
But for that, it's kind of rad, because it's, like, I'm the bridge for, so if you get people who are quite new to photography, not new, but who haven't done a lot of studio lighting or whatever, I'm like that bit between them and the professional.
Yeah.
Because I get to be dumb. I get to be like, I don't know, man. I think sometimes when you're really good at something, you forget that people aren't good at something. Completely. And because I'm in the middle.
That middle ground,
Because Jake's really good.
Yeah.
And then I'm average. I get to be, oh no, don't worry if you didn't understand that. We'll just
You know the bits that made you go, fuck, what does that mean?
What? Really?
How does that work?
You're going to put...
Kind of way,
You know. So,
whereas it's so natural to him at this point that he might not feel, you know, oh, I probably need to explain why we've done that, rather than you do that and then...
But like, and it's kind of, everything in my, everything I enjoy on this fucking planet is engaging with other humans.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah. Like I say, if anyone ever asks me the most memorable things about Dan and Pip, it's, having a fucking fag after a show, chatting shit to people.
Yeah.
You know, actually, and I find it weird because some of those people come into my Twitch chat now.
Yeah, that's wicked.
You know, I like, and with that, having a chat with those people, finding about different people's lives. Like, some of the people who've come on those workshops, like... There was 1 week, there was a guy who'd flown over from Germany, like literally flew in at like 3 a.m. to do the workshop. On the same day, there was a guy who was an ex-military, US military documentary. So he goes front lines, filming stuff. He's now,
he's
still in Afghanistan, still does that, but he's a civilian contractor. Same job, more money. But like, just meeting these people and hearing about what they've done in their world.
Yeah.
And it's, I don't know, I've just always been really, humans fascinate me.
Mm.
Like, I met a guy recently who, again, I don't want to say his name because I don't want it, you know what I mean? I don't.
He's
like a well-known Twitch streamer.
Right.
He's had fucking a harder life than anyone I know.
Yeah.
Literally fucking death. Crack addicts.
Yeah.
He was in prison for a short time for crack dealing. You know, if they got food, they got it from their local church.
Yeah.
You know? he once got paid $5 a head for killing a bunch of rabid cats.
Brilliant.
You know, he's had a weird fucked up life, man. Yet he is more well adjusted, funnier, more balanced, more focused than like the average.
Like, that's what's always the most amazing and inspiring is meeting people who have been through horrendous shit.
Yeah.
And aren't fucked up, horrible pieces of shit. Because they could be. They've got the right to be. Or they've got the excuse.
They've got the excuse.
They can say, the reason I'm fucking horrible is because of all this. And you'd have to go, fair play. I mean, you're still fucking horrible, but I understand it. But. Yeah, it's hugely inspirational when you see people have been through these horrendous things that are like, wow, I'd met you and was inspired by the human you are regardless of that. Now, knowing that as well, it's like, fuck, that's really insane.
And that's the thing. I think, like, maybe, you know, you meet people and I suppose having that position in a band, like being on stage and people enjoying what you do, I think that leads them to be more open to you than they might the average stranger outside of venue.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, completely. So maybe we're in this sort of blessed position that people are willing to share.
To open up
but
a bit more.
What people are willing to share and their achievements to get through it gives you hope for your own life. You know, I had fucking shit growing up. You know, obviously you know it.
Yeah.
Like, but... wasn't the best time.
Yeah.
I'm trying not to hold anything back, but at the same time, I don't want to,
No, you discuss what needs to be discussed. And that's that.
But there were times, not the last year or so, but maybe the 3 years preceding that, I had a really bad time with my mental health. I was still struggling to deal with some stuff in my youth.
Yeah.
And... stuff I'd never dealt with. I should have dealt with it when I was 20.
Yeah.
But, you know, you just put it aside and you put it aside and you put it aside.
Of course, yeah.
You get to 30 and it's still a fucking problem.
Yeah.
you know.
It's a fascinating one, how much on here I talk about how important it is and how people shouldn't be ashamed to get help, to get assistance.
Yeah.
I've never had any help or assistance. So it's a weird one that I preach this a lot. I don't feel I've had anything that has warranted it or that's needed it. That could be a denial thing, but it's still something I truly believe, that it's a massive thing to realise that you need to get some help. But then everyone I know who's had some kind of psychiatric or whatever kind of help, it's just been like, all right, shit. So that was there.
Yeah.
So that I could have done that ages ago. Yeah, I felt, oh, it's this dark, dirty thing kind of thing, you know?
Yeah. Weirdly, I think I hit, like, having the same counsellor.
Yeah.
So I get counselling from a Reading-based charity called Number 5 Young People.
Right.
I know I'm not young people.
I was going to say, what the fuck's up with that? You're old as fuck, dude.
But the young people, if you're below 25, you get counselling for free.
Right.
If you're above 25, you pay.
Yeah, basically.
But because it's still a charity, because I can't afford to pay 50 quid a week.
Yeah, of course.
For counselling.
Yeah.
But I can afford 25.
Yeah.
So they did a deal.
I mean, that's a massive thing too, because people don't realise that when it comes, you get over that big decision to get counselling, you've then got to find someone that's right and that fits that matches and that you're comfortable talking to. And again, obviously not talking about your situation, but in general, that you're comfortable actually telling the truth to. Because I think half the problem with counselling can be that you'll go there and you'll be bullshitting them as well. So what's the point of this?
I had counsellors I tried counsellors, I'd go a few weeks and then, no, I was lying. No, I was bullshitting and just not go back.
Yeah.
And I realised
if you're not telling them the truth, then they're not going to... You're throwing money at them to help a fictional character.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And I realised that it was because most of my childhood problems deal with men trusting them and them using that trust inappropriately.
Yeah.
Right, and I'd always have male counsellors, so I'd never trust them. I'd never let go.
Yeah.
I'd never, and then as soon as I twigged that and went, "Yeah, can I have a chick?"
Yeah,
like within maybe 4 weeks, I'd stop bullshitting.
Yeah,
within 2 months, I'd started to actually talk about the shit.
Mm.
6 months down the line, I'm walking in there. Talking about Facebook.
Yeah.
Venting.
Yeah.
Just relaxed and grumbling.
It's fascinating, man, because it's so case by case as well, because I've spoken to people who have had, who you'd think would have the same situation there, but they found they had to talk to a male or female or whichever is the problem, because it became reassuring to them that, oh, right, that's not what all men or women are like. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's such a varied and personal thing. There's no...
Yeah.
But that's what's scary about it, is you, in a way, were lucky enough to, I guess, get through a handful and then find the right one.
Yeah.
Or were intelligent enough, I guess. Intelligent sounds horrible. That's like saying other people are idiots. But self-aware enough to know that, right, I'm bullshitting this person, that ain't going to work. I need to try another one. Rather than stay with someone for several years... And then come out going, this hasn't helped at all. I've spent 2 years talking to some prick. And
self-aware enough or tight ass?
Yeah.
Tight ass. I'm not wasting my money if
I'm going to they're both great motivators.
They are, mate. They are.
Finance is a massive motivator.
I'm kind of lucky because I've always had, you know, people like yourself and Rebecca and Jake and those people around me to push me, you know, just to... Well, Jake doesn't push me. Jake thinks everything's bullshit and, you know, men should be men. But that's also a push.
Yeah, completely.
Because then you'll realise that men are allowed to cry and like that.
Yeah.
Boys don't cry is the worst thing in the world.
Yeah.
Because if we did, imagine if men just fucking let it out on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Not that thing of once a year getting drunk and just bawling and then having a fight. Or having a fight, then balling, whichever way around you want to do it. You know, I don't know. I think
I cry at the dumbest shit, man. I cry at different TV shows, at songs, at all sorts. It's terrible.
I remember the first time I realised that I was an out-and-out crier.
Yeah.
Was I was watching... it was New Year's Eve. I'd been stood up by a group of friends going to the Purple Turtle. I was like 19. I'm sitting there with my fucking parents in the house I grew up in, and they've fallen asleep. It's not even the new year yet.
Yeah.
And there was a BT ad that had S Club 7 in it. And the dad recognises S Club 7 and makes sure he gets all their autographs for the daughter.
Yeah.
And maybe he has a photo with them.
Love that shit.
And fucking like...
Mate.
And I was just like, I'm crying at that. I watched Fifth Element, makes me cry every time, you know. Jersey Girl, I still think Jersey Girl is the greatest film of all time because I cry at that film in 9 different spots. I even cry at one of the jokes.
There was
me sound like I'm a broken human being.
No, I cried at an episode of The Tweenies once because I just flicked over and it was on Milo, I think it is, like the one that's got a mohawk.
That's Milo.
He'd gone off on his own, he'd fallen out of everyone, and he just sung a little song about being different. And I'm watching, like, look at this stupid shit. That kind of thing when you watch kids' TV shows because you're a stoner or whatever else, and it's stupid. And I found myself, like, welling up. I was like, it's going to be all right, Milo, dude. You're going to get by. It's fine.
It's funny because, like,
fucking Milo.
We watch films as sophisticated entertainment.
Yeah.
I know, like, Lord of the Rings isn't highbrow.
It's fucking great, though, isn't it?
But it's just the little train that could.
Yeah.
That whole... That's the little train that could over 9 hours.
Yeah, yeah.
You know. I just find it funny.
Yeah.
Everyone bows. I actually welled up when everyone bows. If you haven't seen Lord of the Rings, I don't know about spoilers, but...
Spoiler alert.
Shut up.
And I walk a lot and there's some bowing. And it's awesome.
No one bows to you, and then everyone bows to the hobbits.
Smaug, that is the richest person in fiction.
Is he?
Apparently, yeah.
I can see that.
There's a fictional rich list, and because of his billions because he's got that thing or just all that stuff, and it was, I think, in third place was the enemy of Scrooge McDuck. Because he's the enemy, because he's richer, and it's the richest that is listed in some way or some way calculable.
Yeah,
if it's 10 tons of gold or whatever, then you can go right on today's thing. Here's this.
But wouldn't that mean Dude Face Oakenshield is richer than Smaug because he kills Smaug? So
yeah, and then adds they kill Smaug, his stuff. So I guess
he doesn't kill Smaug. That other guy, the Bard.
Yeah. Jesus. I don't know, man. I just heard it on QI. That's where all my knowledge comes from. You know this.
I know.
I'm not educated. I fake education through TV shows.
But do the QI elves have a podcast?
They've got a podcast. Yeah, I've listened to it a couple of times. It's really good.
It's good.
But it's proper factual, and it's funny at points, but it's not. If it's a subject you don't know about, it's not as entertaining. If you know what I mean. And the beauty of QI, I think, is it's rounds and it's quick fire. If they're on a subject you don't know about, then you kind of move on.
And someone will make a joke.
And Alan Davis is there to go, I don't know what you're talking about. But yeah, it was good. It's called, what's it called? It's something about fish. Fish. I've got them on my phone. I'm getting my phone out and I'm looking.
Do it.
And then we will go back to, where were we? We were on your musical career and starting off.
Oh, I have one of those. Yeah, I remember that.
It's not, you know what I'm saying, Invisible, that's a good podcast. Ouch. Doug Loves Movies is my absolute favourite.
Doug Loves Movies?
Yeah, it's really good. Really good podcast.
So.
Where is it? I've put my thing on airplane mode because I'm a professional, so I've not got. What's it called? Something about fish. Fish. Even fish.
It is something about. Someone did tell me about it.
It's a fact or something. It's like. Fish can't swim or something like that.
Fish and knobheads.
Yeah, fuck don't, fish. Don't only eat fish on Fridays.
So what's that
I think
one?
Doug
Loves Films?
Doug Loves Movies. Doug. It's great. It's very funny.
Loves. Got it.
Right, so we'll continue on. So we were talking about you got like an Atari and shit, and that's how you kind of started.
Atari ST and then
programming.
Borrowed
and
the
where
money.
Where did it go from there? For the Mac.
The Mac. And then, like, got into the live thing.
Yeah.
I had these mates, Mike Salmon, who
co-funded the Thou Shout video.
Tim Hooper, who was the other one.
Yeah.
They were both promoting stuff around Reading.
Yeah.
A guy called Tiz, and there's Steve Leek, who's now, he took his wife's name.
Right.
So name, see, Steve Cherry, because otherwise she'd have been like Cat Leek or something, which
it's
is awkward.
It's funny that it's both foods.
It's very foody.
It's gone from Leek to Cherry.
Leek to Cherry. It must have made it easier.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Like these people were all promoting stuff, so I started making music for live.
Yeah.
With that idea of performing. But like performing electronic music isn't the same as picking up a guitar.
Yeah.
You have to work out how to, you're producing everything. The yeah. whole band,
yeah,
it's you standing staring at a laptop,
yeah,
trying to work out how to make that actually engaging for someone.
And,
to
and
watch.
If you want to make it engaging or not, like it is genuinely a toss up at points where it's like, am I meant to be engaging? Are they meant to just be, you can at points, I feel, or if it was me thinking of it, it's like, well, am I overimposing myself or do I need to impose myself enough, but still. If they're listening to electronic music, there should be an element of they're just listening and in the room and in the music.
And like you see it now with how the bigger electronic acts make it engaging is, in a sense, like Square Pusher with he's got that huge screen behind him, but then he wears a visor essentially that is that screen.
Yeah.
And the lighting, the way those lights work are essentially controlled by what he plays, or they're triggered to mimic what he's playing.
Yeah.
So it's like it's engaging, but you're engaging with a visual spectacular.
The whole thing. Yeah. Rather than the look at that individual. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is always the thing I struggled with when performing live, because I like to talk.
Yeah.
But you're trying to engross someone in electronic music. They don't really want you then to break out of that to tell a dick
joke. By the way, here's something that's going on. So what did you find early on? Like, what was your approach? Or was it just, right, I need to get good at this so I can look like I'm doing something? I mean, rather than it look like I'm just staring at a computer screen, so it's visible that I'm doing something.
It was actually like, how do I make this entertaining for myself to do?
Wicked, yeah.
Which was by giving myself more and more stuff to do, you know.
Yeah.
Like, the more I had to think about that, the more animated I became on stage, because I'm bouncing around from samplers or knobs to twist and stuff. And that, I felt, was my way of engaging, because I was purely engaged with the music.
Yeah.
But because people could see how engaged I was in that process of creating. And, like, also gave myself the route to not quite know where it's going to go.
Yeah.
Like, when we performed, there was more structure. Because there had to be, because there's two of us on the stage.
Yeah.
I can't just suddenly
Noodle off. Or finish early.
Or finish, definitely can't finish early.
I'm like, okay.
All right, we're done. So like that, there was more structure, but we still built in improvisation. We still built in places where we could take it stuff. But
and definitely, I think there was a finding of the feet in that, because I think I'd say on the second album tour was when you'd started to build so much for you yourself to do, and at points overcomplicated it.
Yeah,
it's like, right, you can't get into it anymore. And by the last tour, again, you could just enjoy it and get into it. You were doing more than enough to be live and be able to go off on tangents, but it wasn't this, right, I need to be so concentrated. That-
yeah, because there was something weird about that second tour that, like, I tried to make sure the audience knew I was doing stuff. So we had the drum pads and stuff, and we had all that. And it's like, that's great.
Yeah.
But I wasn't enjoying it.
Yeah.
I wasn't enjoying all the amount of stuff. And weirdly, by the last album, I was actually doing more.
Yeah.
But it was natural.
Yeah.
And it wasn't about trying to fucking prove to someone, this is real music.
Because it was a balance, wasn't it, that we always had? Because as soon as we started to get to a bigger stage, that we were playing some big venues and doing some big tours, there was kind of a bit of suggestion of, are you going to add a band? It's like, we didn't add a band on the record.
Yeah.
So why would we take a band on the road? So then I think the pressure was more on you to go, I'll show that I'm a band. Do you know what I mean? Visually, look, I'm a band. Look at all the stuff I'm doing. Rather than, well, in the studio, did you have these pads here and this and that? It's like, probably not. So it's kind of turning it into more of a live thing than the reality
was. Like some of those additions and stuff, like each each thing we did on stage probably spoke, like, taught the next album.
Yeah, and completely, like, always.
Album taught the live show and back and forth and, you know. But with the second album, it was a harder thing to convert to live anyway.
Yeah.
It didn't have quite as natural live flow to it as the first or the last did.
Yeah.
You know.
But again, I keep jumping forward, and as we're over the hour mark, we'll get more into us properly in the second half. But I want to kind of finish off. You're starting to play live and promote in Reading, and you were, because the gig that I came and played for you was with Nathan Fake who was,
that's the gig that it's the anniversary
of. Yeah,
that's the first time, like, I'd been performing electronic under the name of DJ Sackboy,
right,
before Little Big Planet stole the name.
Yeah.
Clearly they stole the name. As Sackboy. And it was like, it was kind of deliberately offensive stuff as well. Like, harder and faster and more distorted and louder than, like, it needed to be. But
yeah,
I was in my early 20s trying to be all and aggressive and prove something.
You and Mike and that rule into, like, DJ Scotch Egg and people like that at the time, that was all quite this hard, aggressive, and being someone like my... You were the one that made me see the good sides of dance music, was getting into, and not through you influence, but getting into Dan Lesac music was what made me saw, because I'd seen the Chemical Brothers headline Glastonbury whilst off my face on pills, and I wasn't into it.
Yeah.
And I'd kind of well, I'm not going to get into dance music then. If I'm in the ultimate dance music situation, I'm like, not feeling it. So I figured it wouldn't happen, but it was that. But I remember at that time, I was kind of new to dance music, and you guys were all like, listen to this guy. And I was like, fuck, that's horrible. And again, I can appreciate it now, and the glitchiness
so
influenced a lot.
We booked that show.
Yeah.
And that was me and Tim Hooper.
Yeah.
We ran a night called I Bet Ya. Mm-hmm. And we then got Cracked, which was Mike, who funded the video, to do the downstairs room, which was his thing. So he had, like, Vexed, who are fucking legendary, like, grandfathers of dubstep.
And,
you know, he had some amazing stuff down there. We had Nathan Fake upstairs. We had you opening, and I did, like, a late set. I think, did Yilla play? I think Yilla played that.
I think he might have done,
He
know,
definitely stayed at my house. I don't know.
He was definitely there.
He was definitely
again,
there.
Again, I'll have to check on the footage, because I've not watched, because some of that is on the footage of...
Really?
On the Rely on Kindness of Strangers Tour. That's the reason we decided to do this documentary, is because I realised I had all these mini DVs that I've never watched, that we filmed bits of it. So I got them all converted, and again on that, I skimmed through to make sure it worked, but didn't want to watch any, because it's like, again, I don't want to be too... But on that, there was a bit that I recognised as out the back of Fez.
Oh, right.
It was after it had happened, and we filmed some of the gig. I don't know if any of it's usable, because I'd imagine the sound on an old camcorder is fucking awful. So that was the first... That was my first ever proper booked indoor gig. And I hadn't really realised it was your first as Dan Lesac.
Yeah, so like, in the months before that gig, I decided to stop being a cunt.
Yeah.
Stop being contrary and all that. And actually...
Oh, when did you go back on that again? I'm kidding. So once you'd kind of decide to go less just aggressive and, look, I'm going to play this.
What? Not even decide to be less aggressive, just actually, like, play the music I make when I'm not trying to impress my mates.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was, like, that was the first gig, and that's why I changed my name for that gig.
Yeah.
Like, I've still got the flyer somewhere where it says, because I designed the flyer for that show and all that, and where it still says DJ Sackboy, and then I had to look it up for that date, June the 8th.
Yeah.
Because I always think it's June the 6th. I don't know why, but it's June the 8th.
Yeah. That's great, because this is going out on June the 1st, so we're literally one week ahead of the anniversary.
Nice. But yeah, so like, and that's like the point at which, that night is the point at which I'd gone from making music as my hobby, as my release, you know. I was in a relationship that was like, at that time, it was great, yet we hated each other, essentially.
Yeah.
You know, we could have stayed together forever because neither of us had the balls to actually do anything about the amount.
I mean, I hope it's not too bold to say, but it's what you wrote the hook of Look for the Woman
in the end of that relationship.
Yeah. So that's kind of, anyone who's familiar with our music will understand what you're saying there, because that's exactly
like she went out and drank with her mates. That was or cooked vegan food.
Yeah,
the bitch.
How dare she?
And I made music. That was my release. That was her release. And you know, the real release is when we actually released each other from this social contract. And
we
both actually achieved shit after that.
Yeah,
I doubt we would have done much. Yeah. We would have probably had a baby by now.
Yeah.
And it would be fucking horrible.
Yeah.
You know, like, we wouldn't be happy. It wouldn't be happy. You know?
Yeah.
We'd probably have a nice dog.
That'd be good.
I could handle a dog.
Yeah, it'd be pretty cool.
But, like, yeah, so that night was the night that I was like, I want to do this.
Mm.
I actually want to do this. And then it was kind of weird because inadvertently that was also where you first heard, I used one of your vocals, you gave me those acapellas, and I'd
done this
crazy mashup with a Block Party track.
Yeah.
It's weird, like, turned it into that, some drum and bassy thing.
Yeah, it was dope.
And
it's where we started working
together,
essentially, and I think we've got time on this part to get into that, but basically my memory of things happening there was obviously we'd worked together in HMV, and we'd met, you know, we'd known people, and I was quitting HMV to do this tour, and you were one of the people I sent some flyers and a copy of my CD to say, look, I'm doing this tour where I'm living in my van. If anyone wants to book me, then book me. I think I bumped into you backstage at Reading Festival.
Yeah.
Because I'd blagged my way in. Amy. I was with Amy. I blagged my way in because she worked for a magazine, and I was using some guy's name, Ollie something, his name to be backstage on the magazine pass. And bumped into you, and I'm sure it was then that I gave you my CD and stuff and was like, look, I'm doing this. Or at least we discussed the music.
Like, yeah, you gave me something. Because you sent me it. You sent me it. Because I had one of the promo copies that's in a plastic case.
Little plastic case, yeah.
Which is over there somewhere.
There we go. Yeah.
It's in that wall of CDs.
Yeah.
Fuck, looking for it. But that was the night I thought, I want to actually make music. I want to actually release music. I want to, you know, and I already had like a MySpace and stuff. And then
it was dope because I didn't know you'd kind of remix some stuff. So I'd done my little gig and I had my slideshow and all this.
It was awesome, this was fun.
I've done that.
It's so weird.
Was just enjoying it and watching it all. And suddenly that started to come on. And again, my record then, as much as I love No Commercial Breaks, I can't personally listen to it, as everyone is with their old stuff, but I can't listen to it like a Flames Jaw or 76 as he is now. That's his production.
Oh, yeah.
He's remixed that whole album and he sent it to me and I was trying to listen to it and I was like, it sounds dope, but I can't get through any tracks because I just can't stand hearing myself or the quality of the recording. But as we'd recorded all that, I'd never been in the studio. The guy who produced it just owned the studio, hadn't produced anything. So to hear my stuff over what
like
sounded...
recording choirs or something.
Yeah. He normally recorded like Christian choirs.
Yeah.
So again, I didn't know how music comes together, as you can tell from that. So to hear my stuff over something that felt like that was that felt produced and this, you know, it was proper beat and it was cut up and it was glitchy and it was awesome to hear. And that kind of birthed it all there. But yeah, that was also the birth of Dan Lesac, as it
was my birth. That was your first. I don't know. I just, that night was an important night to me in loads of different ways.
Yeah.
You know, that it was weirdly, it was also the point at which, within like 2 weeks, that was the point at which I sort of realized that I needed to fix the relationship or end the relationship. Mm-hmm. So that like triggered 6 months of fucking what turned out to be a folly, but at least an attempt to try to re-engage and find what we'd fallen in love with each other for.
Yeah.
And sadly we didn't. And like it wasn't the greatest breakup or anything, but you know,
I always remember it was a weird one time in ways, because you sent me that hook for Look for the Woman and I loved it and the beat and I loved it and I wrote to it, but I wouldn't send you the vocal
because
I was really paranoid. Like, I was like, right, well, I'm not talking about your relationship, but I don't want you to hear it and go, that's what that's what I should do, or that's what I should do, influenced in any way. And then it ran its course naturally. and I could kind of go, so I've written to that track, you say.
Yeah.
I've written to it ages ago, kind of. I'd held off because I didn't want to go.
And actually, that song's like it's actually really reflective of like this new record coming.
Yeah,
because that song is one of those songs that nags at me.
Yeah,
there's beats, there's songs, there's things that like I can't let go of.
Yeah.
Until they're released. Once they're released, I can't do anything to change them. I can set them free as such. And, like, the album that's coming on June 8th is a collection of those beats.
Yeah.
Of those things that I... One of them's fucking a decade old.
That's crazy.
One of them was... I sent to you in, like, just under a decade, in 2007, before we had recorded...
Was it the third track? Because it was one that I recognised, and I was like, fuck, I know this beat.
There's one called Early Days. I remember
bumping
days.
My head to this. Yeah, it might have been that. Yeah.
And, like, the initial idea, I think that was used... We did DVDs of the Thou Shalt video. We did, like, five of them. And it was the menu music. Oh, wow. That. And, like, I just, like... I would go back to it.
Yeah.
Once every 6 months.
Yeah.
And I was like, one day I'm actually going to finish this.
Yeah.
And, like... That's what Look for the Woman was. It was like the melody for that had been around with me for 2 years.
Yeah.
It was something I used to play on the piano. I didn't have words for it.
Yeah.
And then it sort of developed. And then, oh my God, how many different versions of that song were there?
I was going to say, do you remember how we almost fucked it up completely? Because the manager that we had briefly at the time had a dumbass... shitty reaction to it, and that's not hating him. I remember sending it to him and being buzzed about it pretty much as it ended up being like not far off, but closer to that than the versions that we went in.
That really changed from the version he heard to what was released is the drums got bigger, and the bass line, that bass lead is all yellow,
and he came in kind of, and he said, I remember him saying specifically, he thought it might have been a test. He was like, he thought this was like E17 or some shit. And it was like, which was odd, because I was like, oh, right, I thought it was really good. And it was great then that down the line, when it did come out, that it was one way popular. And I always remember a real moment, I don't know if we've ever discussed this, of retribution for that, and knowing that track was worth it, when Sage Francis was like, this has got to be the single. This is like the track on the album. And he's someone that was crazy credible to us from day one. I was a huge fan of. So it was like, right, that dickhead manager, which he's not a dickhead. He was a bit odd, but he's fine. There's no hate or beef there. But it was like, fuck you for kind of,
because it did.
The version that you made after that was the glitchiest, most broken drum beats and all that. And if we'd gone with that, it still would have been a good song, but it wouldn't have been, I think, what works on Look for the Woman is what it is. It's got a purity to it.
The glitchy one. We did put it on something. Yeah, whether it be a B-side on the single. You know what? I think it's on the B-side of the 7,
Of the stenciled.
And I still, like, think that, like, on a credibility sense, that the glitchy one's better.
It's a million times more credible. It's not better.
But yeah.
it's not a better song. I don't care what anyone says.
For heart and soul, for like emotional expression, what we put out. Ooh. And, you know, I'm terrible for tweaking and niggling and changing and chopping and, you know, because like...
I sent you insane a few times, like when you'd send me some demo beats and I'd send you back a finished vocal. You'd be like,
that's not even...
That's just a rough sketch of an idea. I was like, I finished it.
Done
it's
it.
It's wicked. It's great. It's like, no.
And we would have that fight, man. We would have that fight of like, I would want to develop it more. You'd want it pulled back and we'd work it and, you know.
I'm terrible for a love at first sight type thing on music. Yeah. The first version I listened to something, and we had that on Gold Teeth. I really... struggled for ages with what Flux added. I was then completely wrong and it was great, but we're going to get into that in the second half because I'm going to stop now because it's good to end on talking about the new record that's out on June 8th. And what's it called? You haven't told me the name of it yet. What is it on the thing? I put it on my phone. I've driven. I've not been looking at it as I've driving. I've looked at the track.
It's called Cherished Overthrown. Perfect. 0616. I don't know. I put the 0616 in just because, like, I like numbers.
Yeah, and it's the
reminds me of Depeche Mode and stuff. I like it.
So yeah, that's good because I've noticed on podcasts often the first part will get downloaded more than the second part. That's why I was keen that we end the first part, getting the plug
in. Get that in.
I'm sure they'll all listen to the second part because the second part, I think we'll probably feel with Lissat versus Pip stuff because we've touched upon that. Or we've got to the point of us coming together at that first gig.
Yeah, yeah.
And seeing where it all went from there. So we'll get on to
June 8th, Bandcamp.
All sorts of stories.
Bandcamp only. We should talk about that.
Bandcamp only. I like that. That's good.
So, yeah, we sort of touched on it earlier.
Yeah.
Are we carrying on talking?
Hang on. And we've started part two. There you go. Yeah, we've started part two.
You're going to get a drink.
You can get a drink then.
Can we unstart part two?
Let's unstart part two. This is the end of part one. Is there anything you want to leave in the end of part one? Do you want to talk Bandcamp before you get a drink?
Let's do that.
Let's talk Bandcamp now.
And we're back in part one.
Back by no demand.
So June 8th, Bandcamp only.
Yeah.
And the only reason, there's like eight reasons why it's Bandcamp only.
Yeah.
But firstly, I wanted to do pay what you want,
yeah.
Name your price. Mm-hmm. Because of what we were talking about earlier, I do like the idea of giving people the option to have whatever they want for however much they personally value it to be. And that's not a reflect. If someone pays £2 for the record, that's not them saying, you're only worth £2.
Yeah.
It's saying, I've only got
two quid that I can
this
give
is what
to
I
this.
Can
yeah.
spare. You know, I'd rather that. I'd rather someone had it for nothing than never got it for that. But also, as it's a 10-year anniversary of us fucking around on MySpace and releasing records in the cheapest way we could work
out.
Why not do that? Why not let the Bandcamp to me are probably the most morally sound way of releasing music.
I like it. I'm a massive follower and fan of all the stuff that Gene Gray's been doing in recent years and all through Bandcamp and all just direct to the fan base. And it's beautiful and painful to watch because it is a massive struggle at times because it is a case of she'll be fucking putting out so much content, doing like an audiobook, a TV show, two albums, three albums, all this amazing stuff, but people won't necessarily know about it because it's not in the places that they're familiar with looking. So it's a painful but also admirable thing to watch is that watching someone going, no, look, the key part is that I'm doing this work and I'm putting it out there directly to you guys.
Exactly.
And that's what matters. So
and that for me is like, I'm not trying to get big.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to like get back to standing on a stage in front of a few thousand people.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get back to making music.
Yeah, that's the important part.
And doing it through Bandcamp means that I don't have those pressures of a label who have invested money and want that money back from that site, which means I get to be happy.
Yeah.
It's not like the record's free for me to put out. Just like mastering is going to cost £600-700 because I have to get it done well. Why can't I be cheap and get it right? Shit, do it.
£50. Yeah.
Yeah. But like, I would much rather be happy.
Yeah.
And people have it than
completely and
pissy. Oh, why won't Six Music play it?
It's
Six Music aren't going to play it because I haven't actually sent it to them.
Yeah.
So.
Woo. And again, like something that we took ages to learn was that you end up in the right place, and particularly on the second record where we'd blown up on the first and there was a lot of pressure to get daytime at Radio 1 playing stuff like that. And it's like, right, actually, if we get played in daytime Radio 1, most of the people listening are going to be annoyed that we're getting played in because we're not for them and we don't fit with that music. Yeah. But we can get on to all of that in the second half. I want to kick the second half off with discussing the release of not having a label tied into it and the actual happiness that comes back. Because I know something, again, that it is something that you're very involved and intricate in all decisions. So it can be tough when you're working with other people in a label front or whatever that they're going to be doing tons of things right, but they're going to be doing one thing that you might identify as wrong that is then going to make you paranoid that's the reason it worked or didn't work or so on and so forth. So, and we've had that I personally had it on our second record a lot, and you have had it at points. So yeah, let's get into that in part two. But now we're going to break and go and have some drinks and then come back. See you in a bit.
Woo!
You've been listening to Scrooby's Pits Discretion Pieces.
There we go, the legendary Mr. Dan Lesac. We paused there to have a quick drink, a drink break, and we'll be back shortly. The way we've done this, part one will go up at midnight, part two will go up at midday, so you'll be able to have both of them in no time at all. You can have one for on the way to work and one for on the way home for work, if that's okay with you. Please subscribe and tell your friends and all that kind of thing. But you'll know that if this is the first one you've listened to, which it might be, because it's a weird thing. Like, we could have the biggest guest in the world, but not everyone in my fan base is going to be into that guest, if you know what I mean. So some people could be put off. A load more in general will be put onto it by that. But the interesting thing is that that's why the Ask Pip ones are popular, because there's no guest to put people off. But most people who are into me are into Dan Lesac. We came up together, we did all this together, so we built this. So yeah, anyway, on to the next one. See you in a bit.